We have a rule in Jewish monetary law that dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. If something in your heart and you don't actually say anything and you don't make any contractual act, then you haven't created any obligation. You need a kinyan. You need a kinyan to create an obligation. With tzedakah, though, we find that it's different. The Torah tells us, kol nadiv lev olot. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, in the time of the Mishkan, a person would think a thought, a final positive thought, not just maybe, yeah, maybe no, but a definite positive thought that he wants to give something over to the Beit HaMikdash, that he wants to give, for example, a cow, a sheep or a goat over as a korban for the Beit HaMikdash, or he wants to give over cash or property of his. As soon as he's made that final decision, then the thing becomes hektish. The rule of dvarim shebelev einam dvarim, that things that you decide in your heart do not actually have any, do not obligate you, only applies between people. Between people, when we make a deal, when we make arrangements between us, then we say that dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. But between us and the Kodesh Baruch Hu, you can't say such a thing. Between us and the Kodesh Baruch Hu, certainly, dvarim shebelev haven't dvarim. Things that we're thinking in our hearts do obligate us and do have repercussions. Giving over things to the Beit HaMikdash, giving over things to the Mishkan, that's between me and God. That's between me and Hashem. And therefore, certainly, what a person would think in his heart obligates him. If I can just go on a little sidetrack, we have a big problem with conversions. The convert, any convert to Judaism, has to accept on himself all Tariag mitzvot, all 613 mitzvahs. In the past, you had to be crazy to want to be a Jew. But in our times, it's a bit different, right? In Israel, there's citizenships, there's rights if you're a Jew. There's what's called a sal klita, you get financial benefits. So we have to be much more careful about people declaring that they want to keep Tariag mitzvot and they want to become part of the Jewish people. But some rabbis will say that as long as you declare that you want to be a Jew, then that's enough. If you say that you want to keep Tariag mitzvot, if the guy that's about to convert before he goes into the mikveh says that he wants to keep Tariag mitzvot, he wants to keep all the mitzvot of the Torah, even if in his heart he's really lying and he has no intention and all he wants is the financial benefits that citizenship of the state of Israel is going to bring him, then that's enough. What do I care if in his heart he's lying? Dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. What he has in his heart doesn't make any difference. Rav Mincha Yitzchak, he mentions this, that this is a taina shel shtut. It's a very, very incorrect claim to make. Conversion is between me and Hashem. It's not between me and it's not between men. It's not just in this world. The guy that's going to convert is supposed to be getting a new neshama, a new soul, a Jewish soul. It's between us and Hashem. And so certainly there's no room for a claim that dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. But certainly in a case of conversion, dvarim shebelev have a dvarim. They are very, very important things. And what is in the person's heart is very, very important. Anyway, let's get back to what we were talking about. That was in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, we say that when a person would decide a positive thought that he's going to give to the Beit HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, then the thing is already given over. There's been a transfer of ownership already. In our times, where we have no Beit HaMikdash, we don't have hekdish for the Bedik HaBayit. We don't have things that are given over for the Beit HaMikdash itself. Therefore, says Chazal, say our poskim, that all tzedakah in our time is chulin. It's not hesh. It doesn't make any difference whether you're giving money over to the poor, to a yeshiva, to building a synagogue and a shul, or even pidyon shvuim, to redeem captives. The obligation in our times is the obligation of a neder, of a vow. When you decide, when you say or think that you want to give something over to tzedakah, again, we're talking about a final thought, not just maybe, but you've actually decided that you're going to give something over. So there are two opinions as to how this vow is made. But according to everyone, it's a vow. How is the vow made? The Shulchan Aruch, if you look in Choshen Mishpat, in Siman Reish Yud Bet, Basif Chet, he brings the two opinions. He brings one opinion that the vow is made by thought. When you make a you have a final thought, a final decision that you're going to give something over to the Beit HaMikdash, to charity, excuse me, in our times, then there's already been a vow has been made, even though it was done through your thought. And the second opinion, that it has to be verbally expressed. Only if you said verbally that you want to give something over to the to charity in our times, only if you actually said it, has a vow been made, and now you have an obligation to keep your vow. So as I said, the Shulchan Aruch brings two opinions. He says, Yesh Omrim, that it's by thought, and Yesh Omrim, that it's verbally. And the halacha, in such a case, is like the second opinion, that you need a verbal obligation to obligate you in a vow for charity, according to the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. And if we can be stringent, someone who can be machmir like the first opinion, so that's certainly a very fitting and good thing to do. But that's according to the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramor in Yiradeh, and he brings it here as well, paskins like the first opinion, that by itself is enough, excuse me, to already make a vow that obligates you now to keep your vow as far as giving money over to charity is concerned in our times, right? But as I said, it's a vow, and the money has not yet been given. There hasn't been a change of ownership, right? There are certain situations where, because it's a vow, where if situations were to drastically change, maybe you could be matir your neder. You could undo the vow. Rabbis are very careful about undoing vows to charity, but certainly it could be that there are situations where the vow would be invalid if someone were to lose all their property after making such a vow. Then maybe a rabbi, a chacham, would be able to undo that vow. But the big nafka minna, the big difference between whether we say that this is a vow to charity or it's actually been given over, is going to be if the person who made the vow, the neder, dies. What if they die after making the vow? Do their children have an obligation to keep the vows of their father? Or no? Do we say that a vow is a personal obligation on the person who made the vow? It doesn't obligate his property, it doesn't obligate his children to keep that vow. Generally, only if the deceased left a kosher will, will his property be divided up in the way that he has requested and wanted it to be done. Very often we get guests coming to Beis Din that come and tell us that their father said that he wants to do like this, or the father said that he wants to do like that. All sorts of claims. But Beis Din cannot force anyone to keep them, because Beis Din can't even know if any of them are true. And even if they are true, maybe the father changed his mind afterwards, before he died. How can we know? So therefore, nothing that wasn't written in a kosher will can really be accepted that that is the wish of the father. We have a halacha of what's called a mitzvah lekayim divrei amet, an obligation to carry out what the person that died wanted, what we know that he wanted. But the big problem with the halacha of mitzvah lekayim divrei amet is that we have to know that the deceased did actually want this. And so therefore, say Chazal, say Aposkim, that we can only say that there is a mitzvah lekayim divrei amet where the person before he died gave over the property in question to a third party. Where he gave it over to a third party, he said he wants to give $1 million to a particular yeshiva, and he gave it over to a third party. Now we can see that the guy's serious, Now we can see that he really wants this to be done. Only in such a situation, said the poskim, can we say that there is a mitzvah lekayim divrei amet. But some poskim say, and there's a very good, a lot of logic, of good logic involved here, that maybe with a vow to chatzi, that's also considered as a case where there's a mitzvah lekayim divrei amet. If we know that the deceased made a vow before he died, that he wanted to give that money over to charity. So Beis Din have the power to force someone to keep their vows. Right? It's one of the things that Beis Din in our time even have the power to do. A person must keep his vows. So if so, seeing as the situation is before this guy died, that Beis Din have the power to force him to keep this vow, so we do see that there is a pretty clear obligation. Maybe it's as good as where the money was given over to a third party. Seeing as we know that Beis Din can force this guy to give over that gift, so considered as if we do know that he really definitely was 100% serious about this gift. And if that's true, then after a person dies, if we know that he made such a vow to charity, even though the money wasn't actually given over, we would be able to obligate his descendants, the heirs, to carry out the wishes of the deceased because of this mitzvah of mitzvah lekayim divrei amet. So as we said, in our times, a thought to give something over to tzedakah makes a neder according to the Rambam and according to the first opinion in the Shulchan Aruch. In all Jewish monetary law though, we always need, as I mentioned at the beginning, you always need a contractual act, right, in order to create an obligation. But it's interesting, the Gemara in Baba Basra tells us a story about Rav Safra. Rav Safra was in the middle of reading Kriya Shema, and Rav Safra was a businessman, and someone came to buy from him, and they offered him a price. But he was in the middle of saying Kriya Shema, so he didn't answer them. Like any nice Jewish, a good Jew, right? You don't interrupt in the middle of Kriyat Shema, even for business. So while he's davening and not answering this guy that's making him an offer, so the guy that made him an offer presumes he doesn't accept the offer. So he put the offer up. He offered him more. And he saw the Rav Safra still not answering him. So he put the price up again. He said, I'll pay you even more. And Rav Safra still didn't answer. Until Rav Safra finished saying Kriya Shema, and then, says the Gemara, he agreed to sell to this person for the original price, the first price that he offered him. Because, said Rav Safra, when you offered me the first price, in my mind I had already accepted your offer. I had agreed that I was going to sell for that sum. For me, I don't want to go back on my thought. And he agreed to sell for the first price because that's what he thought of. He says that he did, the Gemara tells us he did this to keep the pasuk that says in Tehillim, "V'dover emet belevavo," the person to speak truth with their heart. Right? From here, we see that there is such an inyan, there is such a thing as to follow your thoughts. Says the Gemara that it's considered as what's midat chasidut. It would be here a midat chasidut. What Rav Safra did, for someone to follow their thoughts and to not go back on a business deal after they've thought that they want to go ahead with it for a particular price. This is certainly a tremendous, tremendous challenge to us, right? Just imagine, you're selling your car and you've decided on a particular price, and someone comes along and you see this guy turning up with a really big fat wallet, and you see that, oh, you can get a good few thousand extra out of this guy. What are you going to do? Are you going to stand by the price that you thought to ask? Or are you going to now start putting up the price? It's certainly a tremendous, tremendous challenge, right? As I said, though, we have no obligation. The halacha is that you don't have to go by your thought. You are allowed to jump the price up, as long as now you're not asking more than the market price, right? That you're not allowed to ask for. It's very difficult to fix market prices, to know what the market price for, especially for a used car, is. But certainly you're not allowed to charge, because of the halachas of onah, of overcharging. You're allowed to charge a sixth more than would be the accepted market price. But you'd certainly be able to jump the price up after you see the guy if you think you can get more money out of him. That wouldn't be a problem. But nevertheless, we see that there is such a thing as midat idut, to stand by your thought. And that's a great thing. What if you thought about other things, though? Let's say a guy owes you $1,000. And you're lying in bed in the morning and you think, "Wala, you know what? Poor guy, I know he's having a difficult time right now. I'm going to be mochel him that debt of $1,000. And you think it to yourself, and you think it as a final, definite thought. And then you wake up and you get out of bed, and you get a phone call from this guy, and he's being really nasty or rude. And you say to him, "You know, you're going to have to pay me that $1,000 pretty quickly too. I'm not prepared to wait any longer." And then you think to yourself, "Hang on a sec, I just decided that I'm not going to take that money from him. Am I allowed to go back on that now? When I thought that I was going to be mochel a chov, when I thought that I was going to forego a debt, is that the same as buying and selling? Is that also something that it's only a midat chasidut to follow my thoughts, and I'm actually allowed to go back and to demand payment and demand payment of that loan, or no?" The Ketzot HaChoshen deals with this question. He brings up an opinion that mechila belev, that to forego a debt in your heart, is already considered as if you've foregone the debt. But he concludes that here also, the rule, the golden rule that we mentioned before at the beginning of this shiur applies, of dvarim shebelev einam dvarim, and mechila, in order for the foregoing of a debt to be valid, it has to be said, it has to be verbally expressed. Mechila is not like other kinyonim or the other obligations which need a contractual act of a kinyon. Mechila works verbally, according to everyone. And so once you've said, even if you've just said it to your wife in the morning and you didn't tell the other guy, but once you've said that you're not going to claim that debt, then you cannot claim the debt anymore. The debt, you've now been mochel the debt. You've now foregone the debt once you've said it verbally. But you can't go back. If you lie to the other guy when he phones you up and annoys you and gets you angry, and you say, "Now you're going to pay me that debt," so the maaser, you're doing something wrong now, because you've already foregone the debt. The fact that he doesn't know about it is irrelevant. If you told your wife in the morning that you're going to forego that debt, then that debt is now foregone. But nevertheless, there's an interesting case. Hang on a sec. Let me just tell you something else first. There is going to be a case where dvarim shebelev are dvarim in business as well. Let's say that you provided a service to someone, and at the time you provided that service, you had the intention not to charge for it. But you didn't say that to anyone. You didn't tell the other party. You didn't tell anyone. But when you provided the service, a service, you had an intention not to charge for it. If now, afterwards, you decide to charge, so now you're stealing. You've actually already given over a gift to someone. Once you've given over a gift, you can always imagine, if you go to a bar mitzvah and you give a gift to the bar mitzvah boy, right, the next day you can't come and ask for it back. It doesn't matter what happened the next day. Even if the kid annoyed you, or his father annoyed you, they didn't serve you properly at the bar mitzvah, you can't ask for your gift back now. You've already given it. Everyone understands that. So it's the same in any case where you provide a service and don't intend to charge for it. Let's say do a shidduch for someone. And at the time you're doing the shidduch, you're kulo kodesh. You're thinking, wow, I'm just going to do a tremendous mitzvah here. Tremendous mitzvah to build a bayit ne'eman be Israel. And you make the shidduch. And then you come to the engagement and everyone's asking, you were the shadchan, how much money did you get? How many thousands of dollars did you get for it? And then you start thinking to yourself, wow, I could have earned a few thousand dollars. I could do with a few thousand dollars right now. And so you want to go to the guy and say, no, what about my demei shadchanut? What about my shadchanut money? Right? And in actual fact, when you provided the service, when you did the shidduch, it was in your mind that you're not going to charge for it. So you can't now change your mind and go and charge, because you've already given over the gift, even though you said nothing to anyone. It was Dvarim Shebelev. Seeing as you did an act of going ahead and providing the service on that thought of yours, so the gift has already been given and you cannot now go back and charge for it. Let's say at a wedding, you made an introduction between two businessmen. You've got one friend who has a factory in China, another guy who has a chain of shops here. And you're meeting between the two of them. You say, listen, why don't the two of you do some business together? And they did business together, and they signed a $1 million contract between them. And you now want, hey, what about my percentage? But when you provided the service, if you had a positive intention not to charge for it, that you're doing a favor, and you're just introducing two good friends of yours to each other, then you wouldn't be allowed now to go back and charge for it. If you didn't have any intention at the time you did the introduction, if you didn't think about anything, then maybe you can ask for a percentage. Maybe you can now make a charge. If you thought about nothing at the time, you didn't think that you're not going to charge, even you didn't think that you are going to charge either, but you had no positive thought at all, maybe here you can make a charge. But where you had a positive intention not to make a charge, then certainly it's going to be a problem for you to charge for that afterwards. There was once a case we had in Beit Din of a guy who has a neighbor who's a lawyer, and he had a particular argument with someone, another neighbor of his, about the boundaries between their properties. So he went over and he asked this neighbor of his, the lawyer, what he thinks about it, what he can do. And the lawyer started working. He started going to government offices and pulling out maps and checking where the boundaries were supposed to be and bringing professional measurers. And he went to speak to the people in the government offices, and he had meetings, and he ran up 7 hours of work, which he sent the guy a bill for. He charged him, it was here in Israel, he charged him 700 shekels an hour, which is a pretty good price for a lawyer. It came out at 7,000 shekels, right? That's about $2,500. No, $2,000. Anyway, the guy said, hang on, I thought you were a friend of mine. I thought you were doing it for me for free. The guy says, of course I'm not doing it for free. I'm a lawyer. This is my job. This is my work. When I started doing it, I had the intention to charge you. Right? It's not like the case that I'm saying before, where he provided the service, he had no intention of charging. He had intention not to charge. Or he had no intention at all. He didn't think of anything. Here, the lawyer says he did. He had an intention to make a charge for his services. But he didn't fix a price with his client. That's certainly going to be a problem. How could he provide the service without fixing a price? He should have fixed a price first. So even though the lawyer definitely has to get paid, right? Because anyone that provides service to someone else, even if they don't say it, they don't say that they're charging for it, they have to be paid. They have the right to demand payment for the service that they gave. But what's the price going to be? That's a different question. Seeing as this lawyer didn't actually fix a price with the client, he can't take the high price here in Israel of 700 shekels an hour. And Beis Din only awarded him the minimum price that a lawyer would take for such work. That's all he can get in such a case. But that definitely he does get. But I just want to add on one more thing before we finish about what we said about verbal agreements in other business, right? Verbal agreement, a verbal agreement in business creates a moral obligation on you to stand by your word. Remember, we're talking about where the deal has been finalized, where all the details of the deal and the price and all the conditions, they've all been decided on, and all that's missing is the final contractual act of either signing a contract, making the kinyan, paying the money. All these things have not yet been done, but there is a final verbal agreement. There, it's considered as mechusrei amana. You're not a trustworthy person if you go back your word after such an agreement has been made. In the times, in past times, they used to announce these things between Mincha and Arvit in the shul, that such and such a person has gone back on his word. Beis Din do not have the authority to force him to keep his word, because an actual contractual obligation, a kinyan, has not yet been made. So they can't force someone to keep their word. But you have a moral obligation to stand by your word. Anyone who didn't, as I said, would be considered mechusrei amana. There are some opinions that such a person would even be not allowed to give witness. He wouldn't be allowed to be a witness after he did such a thing that he went back on his word. But nevertheless, there's an interesting thing that if you go today to the diamond exchange in Antwerp, in Ramat Gan in Tel Aviv, and maybe even in Manhattan, maybe you guys will be able to tell me if this happens today or not. Every deal there is closed with the holy words of Mazel Ubracha. Two dealers, whether they're Jewish or Pakistanis, it doesn't make any difference nowadays. When they sit down at the table to finalize a deal, they say Mazel Ubracha to each other. Once they've said those words of Mazel Ubracha, then every diamond dealer knows that there's no more going on the deal. The deal is closed, finished. Even though, according to the halacha, a verbal obligation does not obligate you. But here, their custom between the diamond dealers is that these words of Mazel Ubracha close a deal and are considered like a contractual act. So what's Beis Din going to do? If a case comes to Beis Din of two diamond dealers, one said to the other Mazel Ubracha, then the other one now wants to go back on the deal. Is he allowed to? Can Beis Din force the deal to be kept? We just said before that Beis Din cannot force a verbal agreement on anyone. A verbal agreement is only a moral obligation, and that since there was no contractual act yet. So what will Beis Din do in such a case? Beis Din will definitely uphold the transaction. Seeing as the custom on the diamond exchange, the custom in such cases is that the words of Mazel Ubracha close a deal, that they're finalized, that there's no going back on such a deal after that. So Beis Din will definitely enforce that, because whatever is the custom, even if it's something that the halacha doesn't seem to recognize, there are poskim that speak about this, say that a verbal agreement cannot be a contractual agreement. It can't be a fully binding and obligating agreement. But here, where the custom in the marketplace, the particular marketplace, of course, of the diamond exchange, where the custom between dealers there is that these words mean that there is a contractual obligation now, so that is binding in halacha as well. The halacha recognizes the minhag between business people. But of course, that's only going to be there on the diamond exchange. If a diamond dealer were to go to the supermarket or to another place of business or to the stock exchange and there start doing business and saying Mazel Ubracha to people, so it wouldn't have the same halachic ramifications. Only on the diamond exchange, where that's the accepted custom, will Beis Din enforce those words of Mazel Ubracha, that it's as if there's been a contractual obligation already. But let's say that two diamond dealers were to be selling a calf to each other. Right? One diamond dealer is selling his calf to the other. And they're, of course, outside of the diamond exchange. But one of them, after they looked over the calf and they'd agreed on the price, one of them said to the other, Mazel Ubracha. So here, it certainly would create an obligation. Because between these two guys, those words are a contractual obligation. And that is what is binding, according to the Jewish monetary law, to the halacha as well. So then with that, let's leave the shiur here. Hope you've enjoyed the shiur. This is from Rabbi Shlomo Cohen from Jerusalem. And all have a good week. All the best. Bye-bye.